Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, midwinter warmth and a celebration. Boston gives the New England Patriots a hero's welcome.
Gronk! Didn't catch the beer, but it's okay.
Super Bowl!
Fans flocked from all over to celebrate the team's sixth Super Bowl title. Also today, why Tom Brady is the greatest of all time and why Bill Russell was better. Plus, Congressman Jim McGovern on the President's State of the Union address and Berklee College of Music professor and saxophonist Tia Fuller on her music and ambition.
One of my next goals, I'd like to eventually start a school. But I'd also like to receive a Grammy.
In fact, she was nominated this year for a Grammy and could win this weekend. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and let's begin today with a celebration and a rolling rally and parade. The confetti was flowing. Hundreds of thousands of jubilant fans lined the streets of Boston as the duck boats rolled through the city carrying the New England Patriots and their sixth Super Bowl trophy. Even New England's fickle weather gods showed up with temperatures in the 60s that bathed the celebration in warmth and sunshine. Now, if you're trying to get around the city today, it might have felt like a futile effort to break through the Patriots' defense, which managed to snuff out the mighty L.A. Rams Sunday night. But other than that, it was all good. And WBUR's Steve Brown was there. He was on the press truck in today's rolling rally, and he joins us now from the corner of Tremont Street and Park Street. And Steve, sounds like a pretty exciting event, and I guess things have quieted down a little bit now.
They have. They've been cleaning up, putting away the barricades. The street sweepers come by and try to pick up some of the confetti that's fallen. They're trying to get this place back to normal until the next big parade.
Right, until the next one. Wait till next year. So you got to actually experience this parade from a player's perspective aboard one of the – were you aboard one of the duck boats, in fact?
No, not a duck boat. It was just a pickup truck with some seats in the back, a press truck. It was pretty awesome, Anthony. I got to say, I did this 2 years ago, and it's the greatest way to watch one of these parades.
Pretty good assignment, Steve. Pretty good assignment.
It's one of the perks of the job, getting to see the crowds from the parade route. It's incredible when you make the turn onto Boylston Street down near the Hines, and you can see all the way down to Copley Square, people wearing red, white, and blue for as far as the eye can see. And then you just hear this thunderous applause the entire way. As a matter of fact, my ears stopped ringing about an hour ago. We don't know exactly how many people came out today, but definitely in the hundreds of thousands. And of course, this beautiful weather just encouraged more people to come out.
Yeah, I miss work. And I think I was watching this on television and I saw...
I was working.
You were working and I saw a picture of a kid that said, I skipped school in Ohio to be here. I love that. So, Steve, as we've mentioned a couple of times, there have been, since 2001, 12... championship parades in Boston. How did this one compare?
Well, I think more people turned out. Again, we don't have an official count yet, but this weather, it's the first week of February. We're in single digits of February. It's the 5th, I believe it is. And it's warmer today than it was on October 31st, which was when we had the last one of these parades, when the Red Sox were being honored here on the streets of Boston. It was colder. It was in the 50s. Today it's in the 60s. People are in their shorts, just having a great time.
Now, were there any particular spots along the route that were the most memorable for you?
It's hard to pick just one. Of course, it's relatively quiet on Dalton Street where everybody's queuing up, where the players are getting onto the duck boats and onto the flatbeds. And then you turn that corner, and then the sound, the sound's not turned up to 11. It's turned up to 111 when you make that that turn. You just hear it, and it's sustained. It's constant the entire way. Crowds up by the Hines, they're nearly a dozen deep on the sidewalk. You move further down into Copley Square. That's where a huge number of people gather. There, it's threefold. You're probably, 30 people deep. onto Copley Square. As you get down by Tremont and Boylston Street at Emerson College, there's a building there at the corner that's being rehabbed. There were construction workers in hard hats hanging out of the open windows, waving at the players, and of course they were waving back. The crowds swelled again by the Common, swelled again at City Hall Plaza. Just an incredible sight and incredible sounds.
Mm. So Boston Mayor Marty Walsh had urged the fans to celebrate respectfully. He specifically mentioned not to throw beer cans at players, which is something that happened during the Red Sox parade last spring. Any problems along the way, or did this crowd mostly behave?
I haven't heard any official word whether, I'm sure someone somewhere along the way misbehaved and found themselves on the wrong side of the law. But from my vantage point, the crowd appeared to behave. I did see a few small liquor bottles tossed, but not to the level that things were hurled during the Red Sox parade.
Right. Steve, we're getting pretty spoiled in this city with all of the success that these sports teams are having. I'm wondering if you heard anything from anyone along the way saying, we're kind of getting tired of celebrating.
Not at all. there's almost an expectation that we have a sports celebration here now every few months. And I wouldn't be surprised. Many of the people out here today would be quite happy to be back in a few months amid a sea of green and white or black and gold. Now, that might be a little presumptuous, but then again, we're talking about Boston sports fans. We have high expectations. Right?
High expectations. How times have changed, right, Steve, compared to when you and I were young men in this city? Kind of a different time.
Absolutely.
That's WBUR's reporter Steve Brown, who was covering the Patriots' rolling rally and parade celebration today in the streets of Boston. Steve, thanks so much.
Thanks, Anthony.
So among the big questions about this extraordinary Patriots dynasty and the Bill Belichick and Tom Brady partnership is this.
Brady!
Just how great is Tom Brady? That's the question. Where does he rank in the pantheon of Boston sports heroes? We know what those fans would probably say. And writing today in the Boston Globe, sports writer Dan Shaughnessy says the debate is settled. Tom Brady is the greatest Boston athlete of all times. Sorry, Teddy Ballgame. Our apologies to you, Bobby Orr. And with the deepest respect, apologies to Bill Russell. But not everyone agrees. Peter May covered the NBA and the Boston Celtics for nearly two decades and says that Shaughnessy is dead wrong. He wrote a piece for WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page entitled Sorry, but Tom Brady isn't the greatest of all time. Bill Russell is. And Peter May joins us now. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Anthony. How are you?
I'm pretty well. So you may be the only guy in Boston speaking truth to greatness today. Tom Brady's not the greatest. It's Bill Russell. Tell us why.
Well, I mean, I don't think I'm the only one in Boston that feels that way. I mean, judging from the comments I've gotten. To me, it's not even worthy of debate. I mean, this is a guy who won 11 championships in 13 years. He won 8 straight championships. He won 2 of them as a coach. He revolutionized the game. To me, he's the greatest winner in all of team sports. And I think what I wrote in the column today is that my favorite statistic is he was 21-0 in games in which the loser goes home. And that's just, to me, that's astonishing. And I'm not taking anything away from Brady. I think he's probably going to go down as the greatest quarterback, of all time. And he should.
But not Bill Russell.
He's not. No.
So, no one is. Peter, we asked actually Dan Shaughnessy to join us today. He wasn't available, but I'm just going to read you a couple of things that he wrote in making his case, and I'd love you to respond to that. So, he doesn't take away from what you said about Russell. He calls him the greatest winner in the history of American sports. No one is going to match 11 of 13. But then he says of Brady, it's everything. He's a leader. He's clutch. He plays MVP level in his 40s. And on nights when he struggles, such as Sunday in Atlanta, he still wins because he can find a way to beat you. What do you think?
All true.
All true, but still doesn't make him the greatest.
No, I mean, you can go back and put Russell's name in instead of Brady's name in that sentence. And he didn't play into his 40s, but he played well into his 30s. and was still winning and coaching at the same time. It's not really apples and oranges, but it sort of is. It's because you're dealing with two different sports. You're dealing with a guy who plays on only one side of the ball. I mean, Tom Brady could have the greatest game of his career, but if the defense doesn't play well, he's not going to win. You know, Russell played both sides, as all basketball players are wont to do. And Russell played most of the game, as the good ones are wont to do. So it can't really compare them in terms of sports. But Brady is going to go down as obviously the greatest, you know, quarterback winner in pro football,
yeah.
But not in all sports, and certainly not in Boston when you've got the greatest winner of them all.
So, as you find yourself in the midst of this great debate, I mean, I'm sure you've heard.
By the way, Anthony, it's a fun debate.
Yeah, it is a fun debate. No, it's
Dan and I would talk about this, you know, if he was on the line now, and if, you know, he's a friend and colleague, and we would have a good time talking about it. This is water cooler stuff. This is what makes sports fun.
Yeah, I agree. I wish he were here. And I have to say, I don't really have a horse in this race because I'm not sure what I think about it. I'm intrigued by both of your arguments, but let me ask you about this. So, Bill Russell's run with the Celtics started in an era when the NBA consisted of only 8 teams, 6 of which made the playoffs. So doesn't that sort of weaken the argument in terms of how many times he actually won?
You can say that both ways. You can say it, yes, you're right, it's only 8 teams. But think about the fact that how good those teams were and who he had to face every night. I mean, there were you know, half a dozen Hall of Famers on the Celtics at one time or another. The Lakers had several. He played against Oscar Robertson and Wilt Chamberlain and Chet Walker and Billy Cunningham and all these players. So there wasn't the oversaturation of talent that you find now, not just in football, but especially in the NBA right now. The guys on rosters who, would, you know, 20 years ago wouldn't even be considered to be NBA prospects, but there's so many teams, there's so many places and spaces that you have to fill that these people are going to get jobs. And so you can look at it both ways. Yes, there are only 8 teams. Yes, the playoffs were shortened. But those 8 teams, those were the best players in the world that were playing at that time. And it was a competitive, you know, situation.
So another point, we Bob Oakes this morning on Morning Edition talked to Bob Ryan. He wasn't actually chiming in on this particular argument about Bill Russell versus Tom Brady. They were talking more about Celtics versus the Patriots record and sort of what they've accomplished. But Bob Ryan pointed out that Brady and the Patriots sustained this unprecedented level of success at a time when the NFL has structured the league to make long-term dominance much more difficult. Here's a bit of what he said.
They're a free agency, the salary cap. No other team has managed to do what the Patriots have done with these two handicaps, and they are handicaps. So there's no question with this achievement is astonishing. The rest of the league is truly in awe about what they have been able to do.
So he's talking about the Patriots overall, obviously, but I'm going to sort of substitute sort of Tom Brady in there, doing this, you know, amassing this incredible record of success in an era when it's designed to achieve parity. Doesn't that make him, isn't that an argument in his favor of greatness?
It is. Bob's absolutely right. It certainly is. But that doesn't, you know, I'm still sticking with number 6.
You're not going to back down from that.
Anthony,
not...
Every year for 8 straight years he won.
Yeah.
You know, that's hard to do.
Mm. Yeah. So remind us what it was like then, because I think there are a lot of people who are listening who might not recall sort of those or who weren't alive during those years when they just won again and again and again with Bill Russell.
Yeah. The funny thing about that back then is that Boston was essentially a hockey town in the 60s. Well, when the Celtics went on that streak, I mean, they won in 57 and then 59 to 66. And during that time, the Bruins outdrew them, even though the Bruins were terrible and were awaiting the arrival of Bobby Orr, who came right at the end of the Celtics dynasty. So it was kind of a nice little segue into what we that all thought at the time was going to be a sustained period of excellence for the Bruins, and it resulted in two Stanley Cups, but that was it. But the Celtics had to struggle to draw people. It wasn't a basketball town. And, you know, I don't know if race played a factor in it. It could have. But they generally would do all right in the playoffs. But during the regular season, they were, you know, sporadic crowds in the Garden. I can remember Johnny Most would be on the radio saying, you know, we want 13,909 of you to come out Sunday, you know, it's whoever they were playing. it was a struggle to sell tickets.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you just about this amazing run of success that we've seen from Boston sports teams since 2001. 12 championships and at least one in all four of the major sports. It's quite a time we're going through here.
Yeah, I mean, you can pick any city in America and they got to be thinking, you know, what is going on here? Because, you had situations in New York where the Yankees would win periodically, and you'd have situations in Montreal where the Canadiens would win, you know, periodically, regularly, however you want to phrase it. But this is something that's been going on for almost 20 years now, and you've got somebody either winning or coming pretty close to winning almost every year, and the Patriots are one of those teams, but the Celtics have chipped in there, and the Bruins have. Red Sox have won four. So it's, I got to think, if you're a sports fan in Boston right now, this has got to be like, you know, high noon. You got to be loving it.
Yeah. So one more question, and I want to bring Bob Ryan back into this. So he pointed out on WBUR's Morning Edition today that the Patriots are still going to be a threat to win it all next year. Here's what he said.
Let's say that he were to deteriorate 10%, and I'm not saying he's going to, but were he to deteriorate 10% by next year, he still would be a top 10 quarterback. And you can win with a top 10 quarterback. So the Patriots are still going to be a threat next year.
So here's my question. Let's say Brady and the Pats repeat next year. That would mean back-to-back Super Bowl titles. Four of the last six, seven total, Brady would have more titles than any other NFL team. Would that put him over the top for you?
Is the greatest in Boston?
Yeah, as the greatest. I'm trying to figure out a way to nudge you off this Bill Russell statue.
Well, it's not going to happen.
Not going to happen. Okay.
Don't waste your time. I will say this though. I mean, one of the things about when Bob was talking about was that the thing that has struck me over the years is just how pathetic the competition has been in the conference and in the division for the Patriots. It's amazing to
Good
me
point.
That not one team has emerged as a consistent challenge to them, as somebody that can really, you know, make them work to get their division title, and that speaks to the Patriots' excellence. But I think it also speaks to just some really, really bad management and bad decision making in the AFC in general, and in the division in particular.
Well, Peter May, former writer for the Boston Globe, you can find a link to his WBUR Cognoscenti piece, Sorry, but Tom Brady isn't the greatest of all time. Bill Russell is, at RadioBoston.org. You can also find a link to Dan Shaughnessy's piece claiming that, no, it's Tom Brady who's the greatest. Peter
like
May.
Tom Brady. All right.
You like Tom. Peter May, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate
You're
it. Fun debate. I really appreciate it. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Coming up, a closer look at the State of the Union with Congressman Jim McGovern. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. President Donald Trump delivers his State of the Union address tonight, the second of his presidency. The speech had to be rescheduled because of last month's government shutdown. And the issue that sparked that shutdown, the president's insistence that Congress authorize billions of dollars for his southern border wall, will be front and center tonight as well. But the White House says the president will offer a conciliatory tone and call to bridge divisions. In a moment, we're going to check in with Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern about that. But first, let's welcome Kimberly Atkins. She comes to us from the Boston Herald and is now WBUR's brand new senior news correspondent who will be based in Washington, D.C. She's here with us in Boston. Kimberly, welcome to WBUR. congratulations and welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you here.
Thanks so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, it's great. I've loved talking to you over the years from Washington, and it's great that you're on the team with us now. So White House officials have given reporters a preview of some of what the president is going to say. Here's a bit of what he's expected to say. Together, we can break down decades of political stalemate. We can bridge old divisions, heal old wounds, build new coalitions, forge new solutions, and unlock the extraordinary promise of America's future. The decision is ours to make. So that comes as a bit of a contrast to the bitterness at the moment in Washington. Do you think he'll really deliver that? What do you think?
Well, that's what White House officials have given talking points to supporters. It's a very aspirational, future-looking message about hope for the future. Yes, it is in stark contrast to the mood in Washington right now, and it's also in stark contrast to the kind of addresses the president usually gives. If you remember his inauguration, he talked about American carnage. So clearly aware probably that Nancy Pelosi will now be over his shoulder on screen instead of Paul Ryan this time. The president is trying to get ahead and make the Republican Party at least look more united and give a message of unity, even if that's not really expected to be forthcoming.
Interesting. So the speech comes, as we mentioned, after the longest government shutdown in history, and as congressional negotiators are trying to work out a deal on border security to prevent another shutdown. Now, the president has already called those negotiations a waste of time. What do you expect to hear from him about this particular issue?
Yeah, I don't know how much he'll want to focus on the shutdown itself and the negotiations that led to it, because that didn't make him look particularly good. I think it's true that the Democrats are not really motivated to give him money for this wall to stop another one. And so I think that's one reason why they're pushing this more aspirational theme. He'll definitely talk about immigration. That's going to be the top issue that he talks about. He'll spend a good deal of time talking about that. In a way, in terms of national security, but I don't think it wouldn't serve him certainly to have a very combative tone when it comes to the issue of the wall, the one that has led to that longest shutdown in history.
You know, you mentioned the really interesting optics of this particular speech, especially compared to the one he gave a year ago. I mean, first of all, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, as you mentioned, is going to be sitting right behind him, and she, of course, held firm on no border, no money for that border wall, and even forced him to postpone this speech because of the shutdown. So here's what the president said about that on CBS's Face the Nation this past Sunday.
She's costing the country hundreds of billions of dollars, because what's happening is when you have a porous border and when you have drugs pouring in and when you have people dying all over the country because of people like Nancy Pelosi, who don't want to give proper border security for political reasons, she's doing a terrible disservice to our country.
Wow, strong stuff. Also in the audience will be lots of new members of Congress who were just elected by opposing Trump, not to mention five senators and one congresswoman running for president. So how do you think all of that is going to affect the mood in that chamber tonight?
Yeah, I have to say, there may be even more presidential candidates among the Democrats in the audience tonight, not to mention those watching. The mood is going to be a quiet contention, I think. Nancy Pelosi will be there, but she's also among her guests, for example. She's bringing transgender active duty troops, you know, sort of a nod to the president's transgender ban. She's bringing the new president of Planned Parenthood. She's bringing immigrants and immigrant advocates. She's really using that to sort of paint the Democratic message, even though she herself isn't speaking. It's going to be in itself an automatic rebuttal to the policies of the president.
Mm. What about the president's guests? Do we know anything about that?
Yeah, we know that one of his guests will be an 11-year-old named Joshua Trump, who has been bullied because of his last name. He's actually a guest of First Lady Melania Trump. I think on the one hand, it's a smart move. Already Democrats have come out and tweeted their support of this child and denounced the bullying that he's faced. But on the other hand, it just draws attention to the bullying that the president does in interviews and on his Twitter feed on a daily basis. So it's a tough and interesting choice.
Kimberly, how important is the State of the Union speech to any president in general, and to this one in particular right now? How do you assess that?
You know, this president, it's different because he speaks from the cuff, from his Twitter feed, all day long, every day. Usually, this was a chance for presidents to come into America's living rooms and speak to them.
He's there all the time.
He's there all the time. He's always in the discussion. And so these scripted speeches for him are not his best moments. So I don't think people are expecting a lot tonight with this president that we haven't already heard.
Now, the Democratic response this year is coming from Stacey Abrams. She ran unsuccessfully for governor of Georgia last year, but she's emerged as one of the sort of party leaders. What do you expect to hear from her, and what kind of impact is that going to have?
Well, I think it's going to have a big impact. I think the biggest one is to show that she is not going away. Despite the fact that she lost that contest, she is still seen as a rising Democratic star. She's also a Black woman, which will stand very sharp contrast to not only the president, but the Republican delegation in the room tonight. And along with California Attorney General Xavier Becerra, who's delivering the Spanish language rebuttal. That's gonna be an important message for Democrats to paint themselves as a party that's more inclusive than what the Republicans are right now.
All right. Well, that's WBUR's senior news correspondent, brand new senior news correspondent, Kimberly Atkins, joining us in Boston. She's going to be based in Washington in the months ahead. Kimberly, great. Thanks for coming in. We really appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, for more on the State of the Union and other Washington political news, let's turn to Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern. He represents the 2nd Congressional District. And Congressman McGovern, welcome back to Radio Boston. It's always good to have you on the program.
Happy to be with you.
I think you've been following along toward the end of that conversation, at least. What are you hoping to hear from the president tonight? What do you expect to hear?
What I'm hoping is that that Donald Trump will act like a president and that he'll focus on what we have in common rather than on what divides us. That would be a welcome change. I don't expect I'm going to hear a lot of new things that we haven't heard before, but I would hope that the president's tone would be different from the way he's acted during these last 2 years.
As we were discussing with Kimberly Atkins just a moment ago, the White House has released some of the text to some of the reporters, and there is expected to be a call for unity. But with a big divide over the shutdown, how likely do you think that is?
Well, look, to achieve unity requires more than just a throwaway line in a speech. I mean, it's the way you govern, and the way he has governed for these last 2 years has been the exact opposite of that. I mean, I don't ever recall in my lifetime a more divisive president of the United States. Somebody who has, behaved in a way that has demeaned the presidency and really has shown contempt for average workers in this country. I mean, who else would have tolerated a 35-day shutdown where over 800,000 workers didn't get paid? I always hope and pray that he'll wake up one day and he'll be a different person. But, I don't have high expectations that a lot will change.
So, Congressman, of course, that shutdown was all about his insistence that members of Congress, you and others, finance his wall along the southern border. And I want to just play a little bit of tape from the president talking this past Sunday on Face the Nation, describing the situation as he sees it at the southern border. He calls it a national security emergency. Here's what he said.
And this really is an invasion of our country by human traffickers. These are people that are horrible people, bringing in women mostly, but bringing in women and children into our country, human trafficking. And we're going to have a strong border. And the only way you have a strong border is you need a physical barrier, you need a wall. And anybody that says you don't, they're just playing games.
So, Congressman McGovern, what do you think? Is it a national emergency? Does he have that part right?
No, it isn't. And, and every expert and everybody on our border who patrols our border would dispute what the president says. I mean, he basically is trying to create a perception that is not reality. 90% of the drugs that come into this country come through ports of entry. We're in the year 2019. We don't need a medieval solution to our problems at the border. We have things like, technology, drones and sensors, and there's a whole other menu of things that we can do to do border security better. And Democrats have been willing to work along with Republicans, you know, to enhance our border security. But for him to kind of outline this this crisis on the border and say we're being invaded, it's just a fantasy of his. I mean, he's been watching too much late night TV, but it's not the reality. And so this wall that he's talking about, by the way, is not just $5 billion. It's tens of billions of dollars. And probably higher than any of us can possibly imagine when you add in costs of taking land by eminent domain and all the complexities that are involved here. So there's a way to do border security smartly and intelligently that doesn't waste taxpayers' dollars, and there's a way to do it stupidly. And that's what this wall is about. It's a slogan. It's a press release. It's not real. He needs to deal with facts, not fantasy.
But let me ask you this. I mean, I absolutely take your point about, you know, how to do border security intelligently and in a way that's sort of technologically advanced. But border security, in at least on parts of the border, is also about a physical barrier. So my question is this. Is there a way for Democrats to meet him halfway? I mean, he ran on a promise to build the wall. Lots of Americans believed in that. Why not compromise? Meet him halfway, get a deal on the Dreamers, for example, and let him have some money for the wall.
Well, we already have many, many miles of wall across our border. And again, what we're being told is that the problem continues to be at our ports of entry. And so why don't we respond to the facts? Why don't we do what will work? I mean, why would we go down a road where we're going to throw billions upon billions and billions of dollars into something that is ineffective, that won't work, and by the way, that Mexico was supposed to pay for, according to his campaign speeches? So, look, and if the president, you know, wants to provide additional information that shows that contradicts what the experts are telling us, he should provide that information. But he should not hold, you know, 800,000 workers hostage, and he should not shut the government down because he didn't get his way. The way our system works is that the legislative branch is an independent branch of our government. We're not a rubber stamp on the president, and the deal is that, you know, this is a give and take. And again, the bills that fund our government, including the Homeland Security bill that he wants more money for. By the way, they've been agreed to by Democrats and Republicans in both the House and Senate. These aren't controversial. The only thing that's controversial is the president's involvement in these discussions.
Hmm. Congressman, when we spoke to you a couple of weeks ago, when a temporary deal was reached, which congressional negotiators are trying to figure out how to extend now, you said you were optimistic that we could avoid another government shutdown. Do you think, are you still optimistic about that?
Well, I'm hopeful, and the reason why I'm hopeful is because I think a lot of my Republican colleagues in both the House and the Senate, you know, understand what a disaster this last shutdown was. I've spent time handing out food here in Washington at Chef Jose Andres' Chefs for Feds restaurant, making sure that federal workers who, you know, work in the various agencies of our government who actually, you know, protect our country, had enough to eat and passed out supplies so that they could support their families. You don't govern by blackmail. I mean, you govern, you know, through negotiating with people that you disagree with, and you try to come up with compromises. And this president needs to understand that he's supposed to be the commander-in-chief of this country, not the whiner-in-chief. He's supposed to put the interests of the people ahead of his own personal ego and his own personal, you know, politics. And I think a lot of what gives me hope that we might avoid this is I think that he will get a lot more pushback from rank-and-file Republicans than he did before and during this last shutdown.
What do you think the tone is going to feel like in the House tonight? I mean, what's the atmosphere going to be like? Because as we were discussing with Kimberly, lots of people in there, especially in the House, ran against President Trump. You've got a half dozen people or so who are running for president who are going to be in the audience. What's it going to be like?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's a lot of frustration amongst members of Congress of both sides of the aisle. I think, you know, people have heard a lot from their constituents in the aftermath of this shutdown. They've seen the suffering that this shutdown has imposed on millions of people all throughout this country. And I think what people want is the president, again, to talk about things that we might be able to do together. You don't have to agree on everything to agree on something. You know, when he ran for president initially, he said he wanted an infrastructure bill. Well, we do too. Democrats do as well. So maybe he can focus in on that. But to be quite frankly, you know, he's had 2 years to propose an infrastructure bill. He's done nothing. He's had, by the way, 2 years to, when he had a Republican control of the House, Senate, and the White House to, you know, to pass money for a wall. He didn't do that. So, I mean, again, I'm hoping that maybe there'll be some, you know, some olive branches here where there might be some issues that we can work together on. I mean, you know, I didn't come here to just oppose the president. I came here to get things done. And I want him to, you know, if he believes in an infrastructure bill, look, at if it's a serious effort, I want to be part of it. But I don't want to sit there and be lectured to and be, you know, fed a whole bunch of, you know, false realities. I want the president to focus on some of the real problems that are confronting real people in my district and throughout this country.
I want to ask you about another issue. You made some news this past weekend. You announced that you will no longer accept corporate PAC money. Tell us why.
Well, look, when I first got elected to Congress in 1996, some of my first speeches I gave were on the need for campaign finance reform to take money out of politics. I said that it was big money was a corruptive, had a corrupting influence on government and on the policies that were coming out of Washington, and we needed to change things. Since then, things have gotten worse. We've had bad Supreme Court decisions like Citizens United. We've seen the proliferation of money in politics and campaigns, and we've seen some really bad policies as a result of it. I mean, we had a tax bill last year that came out of Congress that the president signed where, you know, 87% of the benefits went to the top 2% income earners in this country. Basically ignored the middle class and those struggling to get into the middle class. We were told by every scientist in the world that we have a climate crisis, and yet the policies that have been coming out of Washington have been geared more toward helping the fossil fuel industry than investing in clean, green, renewable energy. And, you know, I mean, the high cost of prescription drugs. I mean, we complain about it, but yet the policies coming out of here seem to be aimed at protecting, you know, big industry. So I think that's happening in large part because of the influx of money. And, you know, we're going to have some legislation to try to address some of these issues in early March. H.R. 1 is the bill. But in the meantime, I just kind of feel that I need to do more. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've heard from constituents that they want me to do more. And so I decided that that my campaign will no longer take any money from corporate PACs.
So Congressman, one of the things, as you mentioned, that there's been concern about the corrosive influence of money in politics for a long, long time. Some might ask, why did it take you this long to come to this decision?
Well, to be honest with you, you know, I was playing by the rules. And the rules of the game, you know, are that you can take corporate PAC money.
Mm-hmm.
And when I thought about it, you know, I got some pushback from some people on my own staff saying, well, you know, why would you put yourself at a disadvantage? Why would you take anything off the table? But look, I've been doing town hall meetings all across my district for, you know, especially during the last couple of years. And people have raised that issue. I mean, you know, don't take money from the fossil fuel industry or don't take money from the defense industry. And my response has kind of been, well, let me think about it. And, you know, I've been contemplating this for some time. I just think it's the right thing to do. And, I want my constituents to know that when I wake up every morning, I put them first, you know, and not corporate special interests.
Got it. Congressman Jim McGovern, he represents Massachusetts' 2nd Congressional District. Thanks so much for speaking with us today. We really appreciate it. All right. Take care. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Female college. And so I started off early in my career playing with women. So it wasn't necessarily different. because all of us that came together in Beyonce's band, we all came from being the only women in a band.
Uh-huh.
So it was almost like 10 dudes up in the room like, what? We used to be, you know. And that was one of the first conversations I remember we all had. And everybody was just so cool that when they were here, we're still like sisters.
Speaking of that, mm-hmm. in March, right, you
yes.
actually helped coordinate a show at Berklee that featured the original all-female band, Beyonce's all-female band, right?
Yes, definitely.
And
yeah.
and also the Berklee Beyonce Ensemble, which we'll talk about in a second.
Okay, yeah.
But I want to play a little clip of that performance from March.
Oh, okay.
So what was it like to reunite?
Oh my goodness. It was like a party from the aunts. I mean, it's always a party, but from that point, it was almost like riding a bike to
yeah.
where we did the show and it was boom. We all hit it, and energy-wise, it was there. Notes we might have been kind of fumbling, but as far we had done that show so many times and played this music, it's ingrained in our spirit for the rest of
right.
our life and even afterlife.
Did you have to dance when you were part of the ensemble?
Definitely.
With your saxophone?
Yeah, in heels, in like four in stilettos.
You had to dance with your saxophone in stilettos.
Choreography. And so this is one thing that we really stressed in the Beyonce ensemble at Berklee is that it's not just about the music, but you all have to internalize the music enough in order to reenact it and take ownership over it so that you can do these moves too while you're playing and walking and dancing at times and it looking like you know what you're doing.
Looking fierce.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Like Sasha Fierce.
So tell me, this Berklee Beyonce ensemble, how did it come about?
So when I first started teaching at Berklee about 4 years ago, I remember I spoke to one of my administrators and I had said, I would love to have the girls from Beyonce's band come and do a show. And this was something that I had kind of planted a seed. I wasn't sure if it was going to happen or not. So then this time last year, the external affairs department, they had come to me and he was like, Tia, we have a big show planned for next year and we want you to direct it. And so who are some artists you'd like to bring? And I was like, well, we can do Lettucey or Dwele, because I started a Dwele ensemble. And I was like, well, maybe Jack DeJohnette or we
yeah.
could go jazz. And I was like, well, we could also do like a Beyonce 10-year anniversary
and
concert.
And they were like, that.
Exactly. I was like, oh, man. Yeah, he was like, I really like the sound of the Beyonce. And all I could see was just the work and the logistics. But it was, I'm just so thankful to be given that opportunity because it was not only an educational experience for the students, but it's been a reconnecting point with the OGs, with the band members. And so now we're getting requests to do gigs just
oh.
as a band.
Fantastic.
And this is something that we had always talked about, but I think we just needed some time to kind of all of us settle into our individual careers so that now on the other side of it, we're able to really just hone into all of our strengths,
yeah.
which is amazing.
So speaking of your individual strengths, I mean, we're spending a lot of time talking about Queen Bey,
yeah.
but I want to play some of your music because you're a very accomplished saxophone player. So let's listen to a little bit. This is a piece from your 2012 album, Angelic Warrior. This is Lil Less. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
What do you love about the saxophone?
You know, I remember the first day I blew into the saxophone. I think I was about 8 or 9. I remember I was in the third floor of my parents' house in the loft, and I played like a low B flat, which is the lowest note that you can finger on the saxophone. It was like, boom! And then it just resonated through my whole being. And from that point, I knew this is what I'm supposed to do.
Well, I mean, yeah. you're not the first saxophone player to talk about the instrument in mystical ways,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I'm thinking Coltrane.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. And he is one of my biggest influences,
yeah.
for sure. When I was at Spelman, one of my first transcriptions that I learned, one of the solos that I learned was Coltrane's Giant Steps.
Well, if we could, let's actually listen to some of that. This is John Coltrane playing Giant Steps in 1959. John Coltrane playing Giant Steps back in 1959. And Tia, honestly, it feels a little bit magical hearing Coltrane play.
Yeah, it's a... I think any instrument has that capability. It's just a matter of if you're in tune with it or not. Mm-hmm. And that was definitely my voice. I knew it.
Well, let's listen to more of your voice again through the saxophone. This is from your 2012 album, Angelic Warrior, Ralphie's Groove. So, Tia, let me ask you, you have played with Beyoncé, you teach at Berklee, you've got your own ensembles, you've got some great albums. What's left?
One of my next goals, I'd like to eventually start a school, but I'd also like to receive a Grammy. These are just like some internal goals.
Yeah. You know what? If you're going to aim high.
Yeah.
And I don't see why you couldn't do it, to be perfectly honest.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, I think more importantly, I'm seeing how important it is to just continue to evolve on a daily basis. I was practicing the other night and I'm like, man, it's time for me to get to the next level on my instrument. And I think that's a testament for all of us that we continue to evolve and to cultivate those gifts and our purpose on this earth. And I honestly can say that I'm living a dream because every single thing that I've done has been even more in abundance than I had asked for. And not to have it self-serving, but to see that through me elevating or pushing myself, I'm able to infuse others.
Tia Fuller talking to Meghna Chakrabarty back in the spring of 2017. She's a jazz saxophonist and a former member of Beyoncé's all-female touring band and a professor at Berklee College of Music. Her 2018 album Diamond Cut is nominated for a Grammy for Best Jazz Instrumental Album, and the Grammy Award ceremony will take place this coming Sunday in Los Angeles. That's it for today. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.